ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Middle East war widens as an American submarine sinks an Iranian warship near Sri Lanka. Also, the Iranian women's soccer team faces the Matildas tonight as the future of their homeland remains unclear. And Formula One teams bypass the air travel chaos to arrive in time for the Melbourne Grand Prix.
This is going to be an amazing year with the changes of what they've done through the electric engines, I mean 50-50. And I think it's going to be way more competitive between all of the teams. It's got to be Oscars year this year.
First this evening to the latest on the war against Iran. In a sharp escalation of the conflict, the United States has attacked and sunk an Iranian warship off the coast of Sri Lanka, killing dozens of sailors. Iran has fired more missiles at Israel and American bases, and tens of thousands of people in Lebanon have fled their homes as Israeli forces enter the country's south. Alison Shaw reports.
In the southern Sri Lankan city of Gaul, hospital staff dressed in white transfer the bodies of Iranian sailors into a mortuary. At least 80 people have been confirmed dead, with dozens more missing after an American submarine torpedoed an Iranian warship in the Indian Ocean, sinking it in international waters. Speaking after the attack, US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had a clear message.
This was never meant to be a fair fight, and it is not a fair fight. We are punching them while they're down, which is exactly how it should be.
He claimed US and Israeli air forces will have complete control of Iran's skies within days, but he was more circumspect about a bombing at a girls' school in southern Iran on the first day of the war, which killed more than 150 people, saying the US is still investigating what happened.
We, of course, never target civilian targets, but we're taking a look and investigating that.
But some analysts say the sinking of an Iranian warship has widened the conflict sharply. Don Rothwell is a professor of international law at the Australian National University.
This is a significant escalation by the United States in terms of the area of combat operations, extending quite some considerable distance from where we've seen the conflict really being centred at the moment in the Middle East.
He says although the strike occurred far from the Middle East conflict zone, he believes it was a legitimate use of force under international law.
Any member of the Iranian military is a legitimate combatant.
There are also concerns about further spillover from the conflict into the Indian Ocean region. Dr. Chulani Attanayake is a senior lecturer in international politics at Swinburne University.
Sri Lanka has always maintained that Indian Ocean region to be a zone of peace, but given the escalation of great power conflict over the past couple of years, there has always been the discussion on how this could have spillover effect. So today what we see is the reality of it. The Indian Ocean has become a second theater of great power conflict.
NATO member Turkey has also been drawn into the expanding conflict, with NATO air defenses destroying an Iranian ballistic missile headed into Turkish airspace earlier today. Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong says the federal government is deeply concerned about the spread of the war.
I think the world is worried. There's 11 countries now that Iran has sought to strike. I don't think we anticipated, or any country might have anticipated, that Iran would respond in the way that it has.
Iran has also launched more missiles towards Israel, the IDF says, with explosions heard in Jerusalem. Earlier, Israel's military said it launched a new wave of strikes targeting military infrastructure in Tehran. More than 1,000 people have been killed in Iran and around a dozen in Israel, according to official figures. Israel is also launching a new wave of attacks on Lebanon, where tens of thousands of people have been displaced. The Israeli Defense Forces released footage of its soldiers moving on foot in the country's south and firing their weapons. More Australians who've been stuck in the region are due to land in Sydney later tonight from Dubai after the first plane from the region touched down last night with more than 200 Australians on board.
Alison Chow. As the US-Israeli war on Iran spreads on several fronts, politicians and analysts around the world say the objectives of the Trump administration remain unclear, as does the intended duration of the conflict. In Washington, D.C., Senate Republicans have voted down moves to limit the president's powers to wage war in Iran without the approval of Congress. Laurel Rapp is the director of the US and North America program at the international affairs think tank Chatham House in London. She's previously served as an American diplomat covering the Middle East. I asked for her reaction to the Republicans' reluctance to restrict Mr. Trump's power to conduct the Iran operation.
There is strong support within the Republican circles in Congress for President Trump to continue his war effort, saying they believe that the objectives and the agenda is something that they support and want to see through. This raises a whole host of questions about the degree to which the White House has been clear with Congress on what the objectives for this military campaign are. We don't know yet. Senate Republicans have chosen to give the White House more time to proceed and have not yet sought clarity on what the end game is here in Iran.
What do you think of the Trump administration's justifications for the operation?
There's been a whole host of justifications given. One of the advantages of that from the president's perspective probably is to enable him to maintain flexibility, right? Right now, he's pursuing a campaign of maximum pressure on the Iranian government with very massive airstrikes, naval battles as well. We don't yet know, though, what the end goal is here, and enabling that maximum flexibility in what the U.S. is trying to accomplish here lets President Trump decide when he's going to meet those goals and also allows him to define what those goals were after the fact, to say that the U.S. has succeeded here, but raises many questions about how long this conflict will go on.
Yes, the U.S. Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, is adamant this won't be a long operation. Can he be sure of that?
We've heard varying levels of time estimates from the White House and from Secretary Hegseth. It remains to be seen, and part of it will probably come back to what the goals and the objectives are here. Because if you have a narrower objective, you will likely have a shorter time frame. But if we have this very expansive objective that we're beginning to see emerge from the Trump administration with Israel and targeting the supreme leader and the senior leadership of the Iranian government, reports just in the last hours of conversations with Kurdish militias potentially, looking at a potential ground operation that the Kurdish forces would undertake. These are not elements that are short-term and easily bounded.
Do you think the Trump administration has planned sufficiently for this operation and all the eventualities that seem to be arising?
To undertake military action of this scale, one would hope that there would be a very serious and well-considered plan. It would likely not be made public because that is something that the U.S. government would plan very tightly and very privately. But you would see some public elements of the plan, which would begin with goals and objectives. We could take the Iraq War, for example. There was a coalition built in advance. There was coordination. There was engagement with the Security Council at the United Nations. There was a collective effort at a common task. And we have not seen anything to that degree here. It also has created a whole host of operational challenges. We're seeing this with the U.S. evacuation of American citizens across the Middle East. Very complex set of evacuations that the State Department and the White House and other agencies would typically plan for, because these are very complex and very expensive operations. I've been involved in some of this planning previously with the State Department, and just based on how the evacuations have unfolded so far, my sense is that planning had not sufficiently been articulated internally to allow a smoother evacuation this week.
Lots of interest to us here in Australia too, because something like 100,000 Australians are stranded in the Middle East. What would you say to the Australian government and Australians wondering how difficult it's going to be for them to get out of the Middle East?
I've not seen this level of a large-scale evacuation during my time at the State Department, at least. Best practices is to, you know, find a way out. Get on the plane if you can and stay in a safe place until then.
We often heard during Mr. Trump's first term, when he came up with outlandish policies, sort of not to worry. He's got good advisors around him. Do you think in his second term, Donald Trump still has good military advisors surrounding him?
The president has assembled a cabinet that is different from the president's first term in the Oval Office. We're seeing much greater alignment or consensus or a willingness to operationalize the president's agenda with less questioning and less restraint. And I think that's what we're seeing play out here as well, that there is a greater willingness to take risks, to take military risks, to take economic risks.
Donald Trump came to office promising to keep the United States out of wars. How is the American public, and in particular his supporters, how are they going to respond to the operation in Iran and the deaths of US personnel?
It's a very high-risk move politically. Americans, according to polling, have been widely opposed to U.S. military action against Iran. 27% of Americans approve, based on a poll a couple days ago. That number grows a bit when the goal is stopping Iran's nuclear program, but it drops significantly when the goal is regime change. And we're also seeing growing splintering within the MAGA coalition, of a cohort that is very firmly opposed to U.S. military adventures overseas, who are saying the president is not keeping his word from the campaign trail that he ran on, the campaign of ending forever wars and bringing U.S. troops home. And he is doing quite the opposite here.
Laurel Rapp is the director of the US and North America program at Chatham House in London and a former US State Department official. And while the US Senate voted against limiting Mr. Trump's power to wage the war in Iran, the US House of Representatives will vote on a war powers resolution to stop his attack on that country later today, their time. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. The Canadian and Australian Prime Ministers are dismissing calls for a ceasefire in the Middle East. Standing side by side at a joint press conference in Canberra today, Mark Carney and Anthony Albanese called for a de-escalation of the conflict, but agreed important goals are yet to be achieved. The Canadian leader is hoping this show of unity is one of many. Earlier in the day, Mr. Carney told a joint sitting of the Australian Parliament that the two nations are so closely aligned, they should regard each other as strategic cousins. Rachel Mealy filed this report.
Honourable members, honourable senators, the Prime Minister of Canada.
Mark Carney has become the poster child for Middle Nations since issuing a rallying cry earlier this year in Davos. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese welcomed him to the joint sitting of Australia's Parliament.
In 1854, it was a Canadian, Henry Ross, who stood in the centre of the Eureka Stockade at Ballarat and raised a new flag. The iconic Southern Cross, a symbol of the miners' struggle for justice. In other words, Prime Minister, Canadian rebels with bold ideas have always been welcome here in Australia.
Beginning his address in French,
Le Canada et l'Australie sont de grands amis.
Mark Carney said Australia and Canada are great friends, and when they act together, they make a big difference. Continuing in English, he echoed the ideas he set out at the World Economic Forum in January.
Although we could not be further physically apart, Canada and Australia are strategic cousins. We may look to different skies, the North Star in our hemisphere, the Southern Cross in yours, but we have the same orientation. We share a common heritage, have developed a common perspective, and can build together a common future.
Mark Carney says the rules-based order that was established after World War II has gone, and Australia and Canada must now work together to write the new rules.
In the post-rupture world, the nations that are trusted and can work together will be quicker to the punch, more effective in their responses, and more proactive in shaping outcomes, and ultimately, those countries will be more secure and prosperous.
He says smaller nations are defending themselves against the might of bigger powers by seeking more strategic autonomy, but it may not be the answer. He singled out critical minerals as an area where Australia and Canada should join forces to ensure neither country is vulnerable to pressure from other economies.
Which is why earlier today we've signed a series of new agreements on critical minerals, including with respect to the G7 Critical Minerals Alliance.
He says defence, artificial intelligence, trade and capital are other areas where he sees the two countries working more closely together. Side by side at a later press conference, the two prime ministers face questions about the escalating conflict in Iran. They agreed that it's too early to call for a ceasefire.
I want to see the possibility of Iran getting a nuclear weapon removed once and for all.
We want to see a broader de-escalation of these hostilities. We recognize, we stress, that that cannot be achieved unless we're in a position that Iran's ability to acquire a nuclear weapon, develop a nuclear weapon, and to export terrorism is ended.
The Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney. That report from Rachel Mealy. As the future of their homeland remains unclear, the Iranian women's soccer team is taking on Australia's Matildas in the Asian Cup at the Gold Coast Stadium tonight. The Iranian women stayed silent during the playing of their national anthem at their match against the Republic of Korea earlier this week. ABC reporter Nassim Kadem was born in Iran, and I asked her how difficult it is for women to play soccer in the Islamic Republic.
Well, Sam, it's exceptionally difficult, just like it is for women in Iran to play most professional sports. Firstly, there's obviously strict dress codes. So that means in certain kinds of sports, they can't even play, for example, swimming, water polo, gymnastics. And then there's all sorts of rules in the society itself, which makes it very hard for women. So, for example, if they want to go overseas and if they do want to play professionally in a particular sport, they actually need their husband's approval to be able to travel. And then there's, of course, pressure on them and their families about not making any political statements and, you know, not acting in solidarity with protesters. But we've seen over the years, of course, athletes in Iran defy their rulers on that.
We've seen in press conferences this week that the Iranian team and their coach have refused to speak directly about the conflict in Iran. But what have you picked up about how the team's reacting to the death of the Supreme Leader and the American-Israeli strikes?
Yeah, so, I mean, the players themselves are really limited in what they say. So when you see them, you know, for example, we saw them not sing the national anthem, and this was after the US-Israel strike started and after Khamenei's death. Now, some people will say, oh, they were mourning for the Supreme Leader. But in fact, that subtle thing was an act of resistance, right? Not singing the national anthem. And the Iranian people know this nuance. A lot of people won't know that. And they can't actually come out and say, that's why we did it, because obviously then they'll target potentially their families or make life very hard for them once they go back to Iran. But over time, we know that Iranian athletes have done this. You know, we saw the male soccer team, for example, do it at the World Cup. We've seen many Iranian athletes over time make these symbolic gestures, which shows that they do stand with the Iranian people.
So the Iranian women's soccer team is here in Australia to play the tournament. So the regime has obviously let them travel. What's the regime's attitude been to that women's team?
So the regime, I mean, publicly will always, you know, make nice statements, right? We see it play out. But the question really, Sam, is what do they do behind the scenes? And, you know, I mean, it's really hard. I couldn't actually talk to these players when I reported on this story for ABC News, but there were reports from media outlets that the diaspora follow very closely, Iran International and others, talking about how these athletes had been threatened, their families had been threatened. I mean, these are things that you can't verify. They're hard to independently verify, and the athletes themselves obviously can't talk about it. But we know this because over 47 years, there's been history of this happening. And it must be so exceptionally hard for these athletes. Like, obviously, they're really proud to represent their people, but maybe they're not as proud to present a regime that's been shooting down its own citizens. And how do you kind of deal with that when you go out onto the field and when you're off the field as well? I mean, these are really, really difficult subjects.
This is probably another difficult question, but what happens to the team after the tournament? Do we assume they just travel back to Iran?
Well, we hope so, and we hope they're safe. Obviously, Iran is in the middle of a war. And, you know, in this environment, we really hope that symbolic gestures of resistance aren't then kind of met with a crackdown when they get back home and they're able to, you know, continue to practice the sport that they love.
ABC reporter Nassim Kadem. Formula One fans have descended on Melbourne for the four-day Grand Prix event, which culminates in the big race on Sunday. Organisers say it's going ahead without a hitch, despite fears the Middle East conflict would cause major disruptions. All 11 teams arrived on time in Melbourne, but some had to use chartered flights to get around airspace closures. Bridget Fitzgerald has more.
The sun is shining, it's still, and the sky is clear. Perfect conditions for the Formula One season opener, and fans are ready.
Such an iconic location. Imagine racing around Albert Park in a lake. You can't get any better of that and being in the heart of a city with the vibe and the atmosphere.
Melbourne man Jamie says it doesn't get any better.
McLaren are in their piece de resistance at the moment, with Oscar and Lando being a British Australian. I'm so torn between the two, but I'm so happy. It's got to be Oscar's year this year.
And after a turbulent few days, the event is set to go ahead as planned. Formula One had to recalibrate when Iranian missile strikes forced the closure of airspace across the Middle East. Organisers had to charter planes to make sure they could get all 11 teams, including hundreds of staff and all their cars and equipment, across to Australia for the event. Kai arrived in Melbourne from Brisbane this morning. He says he's just relieved there won't be any disruptions.
Oh, definitely relieved. Especially like for us, we've travelled down here, so a bit of money to get down here. But no, we've got Saturday and Sunday tickets, so we're just looking forward to the whole event. Like, we've seen some videos and it looks like really well done, and kind of we're surprised with how high end it was, even with all the stuff going around. So no, we're definitely relieved.
Stuart Bell is a Formula One journalist.
In terms of the effect of Formula One, the travelling circus is around about 2,000 people in totality. There was 500 that was really needed to be brought out of Italy. That was Ferrari and Racing Bulls, which is the sister team of Red Bull Racing. They were really struggling to get out, so the Formula One chartered planes through Tanzania, and then others were routed through Singapore. So there's no effect to this race. Everyone's here.
However, the conflict in the Middle East may continue to cause headaches for F1, with two key events scheduled to be held in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia next month. Both countries have been under Iranian missile fire in recent days. Stuart Bell says F1 is still considering what to do.
Formula One and the FIA are both monitoring the situation closely. And, you know, these guys are, you know, speaking with promoters, governments, everyone. So as soon as there's news, it will be out. But Formula One is, and the FIA are both, elite operators. So they don't take any risks, and we'll see what happens.
On the streets of Melbourne, F1 fan Cameron says while she loves the sport, safety is more important.
Anyone who's unfortunately caught up in the conflict itself, but also anyone involved in like the teams and all of the fans, their safety should be the first priority. So if that means races have to be cancelled, then like I think that's the right thing to do personally.
But for now, all eyes will be focused on Melbourne. And there's one driver carrying the hopes of Australian fans everywhere.
I'm very excited to see Oscar.
My favourite driver is Oscar.
It helps that there's an Aussie driver in there too.
Oscar, obviously, because that's just so cool.
But Melbourne's own Oscar Piastri is taking it all in his stride.
You know, for me, I still approach racing as, you know, just a passion of mine and something that, you know, I did just as something I loved growing up. Obviously, there's a bit more attention around it now, but for me, I would be very happy without the spotlight.
A bit late for that, I think. The big local hope, Oscar Piastri. That report from Bridget Fitzgerald and Kimberly Price. Thanks very much for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is on ABC Listen. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley too. PM will be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's been less than a week since the war in Iran began, but already it's having an economic impact here. Today, Chief Business Correspondent Ian Verinder on why we're so economically vulnerable to a conflict so far away and what we can expect in the weeks ahead. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.